Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements, and we'll be here for the next hour talking about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. If you have a question for us, would like to comment on the show, or have a suggestion for a topic or guest you would like to hear about, you can email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com or follow us on the Walter Anderson Nursery main Facebook page. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our nice fall continues to move on, and
we're in autumn officially.
I guess we are.
Yeah.
A week ago. 22nd was the autumnal equinox.
Yep. As we discussed last week.
Yeah. So as of 11/19 on the 22nd, we are
felt so much colder.
We are past the equal days.
Yep. We've had fires in the fireplace, hot chocolate. What pumpkin spice lattes, right? That's what we're supposed to be drinking.
I think that's, I think we are.
I don't like those, but nonetheless.
Deep into pumpkin spice season. Yeah. Well, I guess the Halloween decor started showing up after July 4th, but it's starting to pick up even more now.
We saw Christmas decorations in our local Lowe's about 2 weeks ago.
Really?
That shocked me. Yeah.
Well, you know, over in the Philippines, they start Christmas in September, I think it is.
I never saw that.
Apparently in the Philippines, Christmas is a big deal, and they really start in earnest in September. So they're either ahead of the game or we're behind one or the other. But
maybe so. But when you mentioned pumpkins, my first thought was John Clements telling people it's too late now to put your pumpkins in, right?
It's too late to put pumpkins in.
So it's a little late. Yeah.
May.
Okay.
Do that in early May.
Yeah. Although the pumpkin patches around town should start to, I would imagine probably around the 1st of October.
I saw a big one just the other day being established, but I can't recall where it was.
Well, there's one on Highland Valley Road right near Pomerado. That's part of the pinery. Mm-hmm. Right. That's the one that we've stopped going to Bates. It's just, it's just too much of a nightmare. It's still, if you've never been there during the holiday season, you definitely need to go there at least once to check it out. It's pretty neat. It is a San Diego tradition. I'll give you a hint though. If you're going to go, look on Google Maps and go the back way. Go up through Lake Wolford and come in from the east side. Don't go up through Valley Center on the west side. Come up through the east side. There's still going to be traffic, but it's not going to be anywhere near as bad as it is going up Bear Valley Parkway. So you can go up and check that out. But the one that's on Highland Valley Road, they do a nice job. They have big sunflower fields there too that they don't have at Bates Nut Farm. But it's an experience. Definitely worth going to check out. So today on Garden Talk, we have a special guest with us. We have Shay O'Keefe, who is the wildlife biologist for Southern California for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Welcome to the show, Shay.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to come in and talk to us about what's going on with the USDA.
Absolutely.
You want to give us a little bit of background on
Sure.
what you're doing? How you got here and what you're doing?
Absolutely. So I've been with USDA here for over 20 years.
Wow.
I can't believe it. I know. I know. I look so youthful.
I was going to say you joined the USDA when you were nine.
Yeah. Yes, a long time. And before I came on with USDA, which actually was my very first job in my field, I was a grad student at SDSU in the population genetics department, doing mountain lion research. So yeah, that's my background.
Wow.
So I'm a mammalogist by trade and then geneticist in my graduate work. Then got a job with USDA and had people ask me questions like, what's this blade of grass? Like, I have no idea. So the good news is I'm constantly learning new things.
Oh, very good. Well, you worked for the USDA. Well, maybe you knew my son. He worked for the USDA.
I might have. Small world.
Yeah. It's funny. I have a neighbor who's an airline pilot, and he said people ask him all the time, oh, you know, I have a friend of mine who's an airline pilot. Maybe you know him. He goes, Because I don't know. We've got like 10,000 pilots. I haven't met all of them.
Yes, right.
Anyway, so you went to, say, you got your undergraduate from San Diego State as well?
Both, yeah. Undergrad and my graduate work is there.
So are you a native San Diegan?
I am.
Okay.
Oh, generation.
Right. Generation.
Wow.
Which generation?
Third.
Third.
Wow. Okay.
Grew up in South San Diego.
Okay.
Dad as well. Grandmother as well.
Yeah.
It's almost like Ken here.
I'm just a second generation.
Almost. Yeah,
both of my parents grew up here. Grew up in Bay Park.
I lived there for a hot minute.
Yes. Yeah, I grew up there. As a matter of fact, my parents and my sister still live very close to Bay Park. And my grandfather, who started the business, they still own his house in Bay Park. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about what you're doing now with the USDA.
So my job now is very broad. So like I said before, I'm the Southern California biologist, so I get to go all over the place, but primarily working with farmers and ranchers and forest landowners. So I get to help ranchers, farmers develop habitat for wildlife on their properties. Usually there's an angle for them that's like an integrative pest management approach.
Oh, interesting.
Right. Pollination services for crops. And then our range community usually have so much land that they're very willing to kind of install certain areas on the property that's good for wildlife. And then in the forest lands, really the biggest concern in that arena is fuels reduction. So my job for that arena is more of a compliance angle to make sure that we're not taking out really good trees, wildlife and snags, denning habitat, bat type habitat, spotted owl. So it's more of a compliance world.
Okay. No, hold on just 1 second. I need to... Excuse the technical difficulties, folks. Okay. That should be better.
Okay.
Okay. So as far as the forest management, removing fuel and things like that, how much of the fuel that is being removed, is any of it recyclable or be able to be used for lumber? I know that typically the forests in our area are not what you would find for lumber and things like that, but are there uses for that stuff for that fuel that you're removing from the site?
There is, and like you alluded to, we don't have the mills down in Southern California like they do in Northern, so we're not, you know, sending them to a site to be processed for lumber, but we do use some of it for recyclable material that go onto playgrounds. There's a company that does that. A lot of it does get chipped and used on place for things like erosion control, moisture retention. So a lot of it does get chipped on site. We try and use as much material on site, kind of scatter it around. And when we say fuels reduction, we're talking about the area around trees, which create ladder fuel. So we're not going and doing big broad scale projects where we're just removing a whole bunch of trees. It's really targeted removal, ingress, egress sites. Around, we got to stay around homes is really up to the county, but we do a lot of fuels, ladder fuels around
particular
trees. Yeah.
I find that interesting that falls to the Department of Agriculture more than it does
forestry
or Bureau of Land Management. BLM.
Yeah.
So here's the catch, and I forgot to mention this in the beginning, but NRCS is the only agency that deals directly with private landowners. Forest Service is responsible for managing Forest Service property, which is huge. But NRCS, USDA, NRCS standing for Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is an agency under USDA, is targeted with our primary purpose is to work with private landowners. So we coordinate with the Forest Service to get that kind of like big scale response. But we are private land.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Learning something.
Yeah, that, right.
We just every did. Day. I did every day. Yeah. If you don't, you're not here anymore.
But that makes perfect sense.
Yes.
When somebody that knows what they're talking about explains it.
Exactly. And not us.
Exactly.
When you were talking about for private ranches and farmers' habitat for wildlife. Is that like all wildlife where the farmers wouldn't have a risk of predators coming in if they were, you know, cattle farmers or something? Or how does that work?
Yeah, there is. We've just started to get into that arena for like protection of livestock from predation, especially as the wolves are moving down from the northern part of the state to the southern part. We're now becoming a little bit more active in that. It's a new area, though, that predation stuff. Primarily what I get to work with is improving pollinator habitat. If a landowner is usually interested in bringing in more deer, then I can say, yeah, this is what you'd want to do. Quail, landowners love having quail, so brush piles for that. But as long as it's not ladder fuels. But yeah.
Conflicting offices.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of it is people just, and we call it kind of a gateway practice where they're saying, hey, I love butterflies. I've been seeing a lot of butterflies. What can I do for them? So once I get them in the door with, hey, we've created habitat for butterflies, now we can start talking big scale stuff if they're willing. But again, it's private lands and it's voluntary. So whatever they want to do, I'm here to help them technically with it. And under the Farm Bill, which is an NRCS USDA program, we can pay for it as well.
You know, that brings up a, for me, an interesting question. Why would a range or ranch owner want to encourage more deer on their property?
They like to hunt them.
I was going to say, where I grew,
to harvest them.
I was going to say, that's where I grew up. It's venison, and we want that.
Yeah. And in different parts of the state, you get different motivations. Down here, we are blessed with having a lot of ranchers that want to do right by the land. They're usually, I don't want to say hobby ranchers, but they're also folks that like, they love just having the open space. So they're usually already wildlife minded, where in the north, you might get somebody who wants deer because they want to go out and turkeys is another one.
Right.
So yeah, it could be a sport thing.
Interesting. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ, and our special guest, Shay O'Keefe from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements, and our special guest, Shay O'Keefe, who is a wildlife biologist for Southern California from the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture. We were talking as we went into the break about landowners, ranchers in Southern California and creating more habitat for some of the wildlife in San Diego. And Southern California. You mentioned that we touched briefly on the predatory thing. And I was not aware that we had released wolves in California. So
they're migrating over from where they released them, I believe, in New Mexico, maybe.
Okay.
Now I'm probably speaking incorrectly, but it was
I know in Wyoming and I think Wyoming and Colorado, we had some friends that just did an extensive trip through Yellowstone this summer, and they saw a lot of wolves in Yellowstone. So, well, that's
good.
Interesting. Yep. I know it's good, a little scary, but
any sign of wolves in San Diego County?
No, not yet. Okay. The southernmost that we have tracked them is Bakersfield.
Wow. That's good. It's creeping in.
It is. But with wildlife in San Diego County, and that's where most of our listeners are based, besides the more common wildlife, what are things that we wouldn't typically think are here that we have? I mean, we have mountain lions and bobcats and rattlesnake under
we spotted spotted a big bobcat in our backyard our trail cam just about 10 days ago. They're out there.
Well, one of my favorites is the ringtail cat, which we didn't even know was here until maybe 15, 20 years ago. Caught it on a trail cam. So they're super elusive, kind of like our fox, our gray fox, which is native. The red fox is not native.
I didn't know that.
So those two mammals you just don't see very often, and they're out there, and they're kind of my favorite. Also, the American badger. I love badgers. you can often find their dens. They're these nice big burrows in the ground, usually under a nice shady oak tree.
Here in San Diego County.
Yep. Yeah.
That's another one that I have not come across yet, fortunately.
Do we have a ferret or weasel type critter?
We have a long-tail weasel. I actually saw one of those in Ramona on the road.
My neighbor asked me if I had gotten a ferret or a weasel once, and I said, no, why? And she's like, I could have sworn I saw one in your side yard.
Yeah.
And a couple of days later, we kept finding half rat pieces in my backyard over days, and that's what was there.
Yes, doing its job.
Doing its job. I want to try to get one for where we live here in Poway.
Yeah. Yeah, they're neat. I like them.
A little historical fact. I'm not sure if you've heard it or not, but talking about predatory things. The largest California grizzly that was ever taken was shot in Valley Center.
Wow.
2,300 pounds?
Yeah.
Something like it. At the beginning of the last century.
Oh my God.
It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah. Wow.
In Bear Valley?
In Bear Valley. Oh, that's why it's Bear Valley Parkway.
Not far from Lake Wolford.
Far at all. So I remember when I heard that statistic, I was, I'm kind of glad they're extinct.
Yeah.
Cause I had no idea that their range came that far south, but it was in, I think it was 1919 or something like that was when
I think that one,
shot.
I think the Valley Center bear was in the 1880s.
Was it? I thought it was right at the turn of the century.
The last grizzly killed in California, I think it was 1929 at Mount Pinos.
Oh,
Up in LA area.
Interesting.
But, yeah. Sad.
It is.
Yeah, yeah. Whenever the demise of something like that. That is sad. But a little interesting fact.
I've never seen a fox here.
Yeah, they're really hard to
find.
They're
elusive, obviously.
Yeah. They love to put their scat on top of rocks though. Hmm. So if you see that when you're hiking around and it's small enough, it's highly likely that it's a fox.
That's interesting. I've seen foxes here in San Diego. It was a red fox, so I didn't know that they were not indigenous. But we had one that had set up camp at our San Diego store years ago, and it lived on the property and just ate rodents. And we would spot it running around through the plants periodically. We would see them. I live in Scripps Ranch and have for the past close to 30 years or so. And our house butts up to a green belt that runs between us and the condo complex behind us. And one of the animals that we used to see on a relatively regular basis, but I have not seen them in a long time, was quail. Mm-hmm. And we would see, and families of quail would come in, they'd move. That green belt is like a highway, mostly for coyotes, but all kinds of stuff goes through there. But every once in a while, families of quail would come through the yard, and it would be a mother and like six or seven chicks, and they would follow each other around. But I haven't seen any in quite a while.
You might want to put down some brush piles. They love that ground cover.
Unfortunately, the HOA comes through and cleans all that stuff out.
You put that in, and then the fire department comes. It's a conflict. Right. We have them up by our place. We were having coffee on the front porch and in the morning and watched, I don't know, I think we counted 17 whale. We live right above Lake Poway.
Okay.
And so they just, this big, and they all, they're almost like a school of fish, the way they march.
Yeah.
It was kind of neat to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the other birds that you mentioned, we were talking about it a little bit during the break, turkeys.
Mm-hmm.
And I had mentioned that I don't play golf often, but when I do, it's usually at Madera's. And the amount of turkeys that are around Madera's golf course is amazing. Large groups of them too, 6-7 birds at a time. And sometimes they're hanging out underneath the oak trees. Other times they're just cruising around. Mm-hmm. And had mentioned on the University of California Integrated Pest Management website, turkeys are actually listed as a nuisance pest in California. Can you give any information on that? It doesn't seem like something that you would consider a nuisance, really.
You know, they have a tendency to scratch through and pull up a lot of native plants. So I'll tell you though that the feral pig is way worse than the wild turkey. Yeah, they grub and they take out all kinds of nice native bulbs out there, like dudleas, and it can be quite disastrous. Turkeys, now there's a lot of debate out there. So turkeys are not as invasive, from what I've seen anyway, as like a feral pig, but mm-hmm. they can be prolific and they can have effects. But they're also a food source for some of our top predators. So
they're big. It's a big bird.
It is.
It's a decent sized bird.
Are they native? Well, turkeys, or are these the kind John, our native, our historian for agricultural historian for yes. San Diego, you know, you wrote an article once about the turkeys and Ramona being the turkey capital of the world, of the United right. States anyway. In the 40s, they had, I remember them seeing a picture of like Miss Turkey, whatever.
They had turkey days.
Over the years. And are these guys escapees from the Ramona farm?
What do you think?
No, they were introduced for hunters, actually. So, but they're not native turkeys to this area. Yeah. Native to the United States. Not
right. I was just curious
county,
if we had any, indigenous turkeys besides me.
That brings up the question that I had about the feral pigs, which I didn't realize we had an issue with them in Southern California. Are they're not indigenous, are they?
No, they are definitely not. I know Vulcan Mountain struggles with them quite a bit. They're making their way all through the county now in the kind of the back country. So yeah, they can be pretty disastrous.
That's amazing. I had no idea.
Yeah.
That's one pest that has not come across our customer service desk recently. So usually when the most common thing that we find when things are grubbing in people's yards, skunks.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually skunks and it's usually in a lawn and they're usually going after grubs. Yep. And they will just absolutely decimate people's lawns trying to get to the grubs.
Yep.
So we just tell people you get the grubs under control and the skunks will just move on.
Right.
We're looking for something else.
Yeah.
So any other major animal pests that have come to light recently or have become more of a problem? Recently?
I'm on working land, so I get to chat with a lot of farmers, but boy, they have issues with ground squirrels and with gophers.
We have noticed that ourselves. Yeah. A lot of our customers, especially from up in Ramona and some of the outlying rural areas, and George here in Poway has had some issues with them. Adams, who our other manager here in in Poway, who lives in Ramona, he has had lots of issues with mm-hmm. ground squirrels.
Yeah,
it's become quite a problem.
Well, there's been a number of articles about ground squirrels becoming carnivorous.
Mm.
Are you seeing that? Are you anything down
Gosh,
this way?
Gosh, that sounds awful. No, I haven't.
Actually, I like it. I like it because if they're going in a hole and finding a gopher, and they're at least 50% of my problem is been removed.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Hmm. And we come on the scene when we have folks that are interested in doing something to try and control them. You know, there's kind of a toolbox of approaches. And one of them is we recommend people putting up barn owl boxes. So not the plastic ones. Mm-hmm. There's been a few that I've seen that I'm like, oh, please don't use it. Mm. What owl likes to nest in? I don't want to live in plastic.
They look like plastic igloos.
They
or
do.
Something. Yeah, they're dreadful.
Yes. But the USDA has a lot of nice hand-drawn specs that we put together to help guide people on how to build a proper barn owl box. Mm. Raptor perches, bringing in the big predator birds to try and help control. Squirrels are diurnal, right? So they're active during the day. So that's when you want something like raptor perch, where your gophers are nocturnal. So you build those barn owl boxes and you've got that night predation going on. So there's a lot of different things you could do. Not saying it fully controls things, but it can help.
It can reduce. It can mitigate. It's a mitigating step, right?
Mitigates it and doesn't cause a lot of secondary issues, damage, secondary issues like some of the poisons and the traps can do.
You can't purchase poison at a store anymore for squirrels.
Okay.
We don't sell ground squirrel poisons.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one thing that's changed a lot over the past, I would say the past 7 or 8 years. There's been a lot of things that have come and gone. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements and our special guest, Shay O'Keefe from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements, and our special guest, Shay O'Keefe from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She is the wildlife biologist for Southern California. During the break, we were chatting about predatory birds in Southern California and San Diego, and I was mentioning how when we built the store here in Poway in the late 1990s, or the late 1900s, as I now refer to it, there was a lot of raptor activity up here in the business park, because a lot of the business park hadn't been built out yet. As time has gone on and the park grew, that raptor activity dropped off fairly dramatically, almost to the point of non-existence. But as time has gone on, the raptors have moved back into this area, and we see them on a very regular basis now. So they've adapted to the new environment. Maybe not as great a population as there used to be, but they have come back. And living in Scripps Ranch, there's a huge raptor population over in Scripps Ranch. We see them all the time in our neighborhood. As a matter of fact, we had two big hawks, big Agonis tree in our backyard, and one of them came in and landed and was there for several minutes, and then it started screeching, and just a few minutes after it started screeching, another one came in and landed in the tree, and then they both took off together. Owls are another one that you had mentioned. Mm-hmm. And you never see them, mm-hmm, really, because they come out at night, or they're nocturnal.
I was going to say, you say never, but I see them probably once every 3, 4, or 5 weeks.
Yeah, see,
where we live.
We hear them in our yard, because that was the other thing that amazed me about owls, is how loud they are. They mm-hmm. are really,
they're silent flyers.
They're,
but that's it.
But yeah, when they're talking to each other, they are loud. And we went out one night, we knew one was in the yard, and sure enough, it was up in the tree, and it was dark, but you could see its silhouette. It was huge. Yeah. It was a big bird. So mm-hmm. you would said it's a great horned owl.
Probably a great horned. Yeah. If you hear that, and they kind of talk back and forth, that's our great horned owls. And they're very acclimated to our kind of more neighborhood environments. Mm-hmm. They can tolerate a lot. And then if you hear that kind of a screech where you're like, oh, that's just an awful sound, that's probably a barn owl.
Okay.
Great horns will lace barn owls. They're a little bit more aggressive than our nice white-faced barn owls. But you see more barn owls out in kind of the rural interface settings. Great horns will be in neighborhoods.
And the great horn, that's a much bigger bird than a barn owl.
Yeah.
One of the things that we used to like to see when we would go to Bates Nut Farm is they had, I can't remember what organization there, but it was a wildlife organization, would come and they would set up a booth and they would talk to people, and they had a great horned owl mm-hmm. that was one of their animal ambassadors. And it sat on a big trunk that they had of a tree in their booth. Beautiful bird, mm-hmm. absolutely gorgeous bird, but that thing was probably close to 2 feet tall.
Yeah.
It was big. Huge, huge. Yeah. And it would just sit there and stare at you.
Yeah.
It was pretty neat.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking in the previous show about mosquito control, and one of the things that does mosquito, I believe, controls mosquitoes in San Diego, bats.
Yes,
the bat population in San Diego.
Yeah.
I personally have never seen a bat in San Diego myself.
Oh, you need to come up at sunset and have a glass of wine on our front porch, because we sit there and watch them. Oh, there's one.
But there again, it's a nocturnal animal. You really see them, but they can play a huge role in pest control.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that, because I left my office in Escondido last week and I was late for something. So I was running down the stairwell, opened two doors, ran down the stairwell. Bat flew right past me in the stairwell. And I thought, oh, I don't have time to try and get this bat. You know, all these things going through my, oh, I got to go. And then I get a call from one of my coworkers, and she's like, there's a bat in your office. Like, it flew through both doors and went straight to my office. So it was pretty neat.
In the daytime?
Yes. Yeah.
Maybe it's a vampire bat. It
wasn't big enough.
But, okay.
Also, but yeah, bats do control a lot of insects.
Yes. Yeah, just this week in Del Mar, we have a client that has bats in all of their can lights on their patio.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So at sunset, if they're having a party, they have to be careful because suddenly the bats are flying out of these cups and then through the yard.
Now, are they the bat species that is indigenous to Southern California? Is that the Mexican free-tail bat?
Or? We have a lot. We have the pallid bat, Townsend big ear bat. A lot of them are sensitive because they used to, you know, have a lot more cavities and caves to kind of roost in, and they've lost a lot of that habitat. So we do also have specifications for building bat boxes, which is something people can use. I actually built one with my kids at their school. They loved it. And then they can see if the bats are using them because there's the little scratch marks up them, and they can see the bat guano at the bottom.
Okay. Yeah. I've noticed when we go hiking out through the Peñasquitos Canyon Preserve, there's a number of bat boxes placed out in the preserve over there, which makes sense because you have the creek or sometimes standing water in the preserve over there, so they can feed off of that.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting things I have ever seen, years ago, I was back in New Mexico with my three oldest kids, and we had gone to Carlsbad Caverns late in the afternoon or later in the afternoon. And as we were getting ready to leave, they said, if you can stick around, the bats are going to come out around 5 o'clock, I guess it was, whatever. So we did some driving around, and we went back and sat in the amphitheater. And that was one of the most amazing things I have ever seen. Yeah. And if you've never been to Carlsbad, it's almost a natural amphitheater at the mouth of the cave. And the ranger comes out and he starts talking about it and everything that's going on with the bats and gives you more information than you ever really wanted to know about them. And then he said, oh, and here they come. And it's like a cloud that just comes up out of the cave. It looks almost like a tornado.
Yeah.
And they just swirl around until they get to the altitude that they want. And then it just trails off across the desert. It's just millions of these little Mexican free-tail bats. It is absolutely incredible to see.
Yeah. I don't know how many native species we have.
25.
There you go. You Googled it, didn't you?
No, I didn't Google it. I use the integrated pest management. That's our Bible.
Okay.
So I had that open while we were chatting. There are 25 species in California.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It is. And we, like I said, you know, we do see them in the evening when we sit out front. And it's amazing the way that I don't want to dwell on bats, but their radar, they'll be flying and just the way that they jerk left, right. You'd be pulling a lot of G's if you were a pilot, you were doing that. So to get whatever they're going after. But what I wanted to try to get to, Ken, and if we can, is when, you know, one of the reasons we wanted to bring her when she and I talked about coming in here and doing this was, you know, she mentioned pollinators for some of the farmers and ranchers. Pollinators, you know, what kind of pollination are you, besides bees? Everyone thinks bees instantly when you say pollinators, but what do you guys do with the pollinator piece?
So, and this is where, you know, working with a nursery is so fantastic, but mostly it's the planting that bloom period year round as much as you can. And in San Diego County, you can get pretty close. You can get from February all the way to November if you incorporate something like coyote bush in there. So you really want that year round bloom period with a planting effort. Removing invasives is kind of the first step to do that if there is that presence there. So you'd want to get a good native plant bloom period that these pollinators have evolved with over thousands of years, right? There's all great other pollinators like bats. Bats are good pollinators. Butterflies are good pollinators. Mm-hmm. The bees are really kind of the workhorse behind it. And if we're throwing out numbers, like we've got over 700 native bees in this county.
Yeah, I remember that. The bee collection at the Natural History Museum is pretty impressive when you're looking in the drawers where they have them all, have the samples all laid out.
End up, yeah. So that's what we try and do. And then we use insecticides, rodenticides, neonicotinoids. I always have a hard pronouncing culprit, that one. Yeah. And then overwintering habitat. So things like deer grass is fantastic, creeping wild rye, giant wild rye, any of those plants that have the pithy centers like elderberry, where those tunnel nesting bees can get in there. So we're trying to incorporate a big plant palette, overwintering opportunities, reduction in insecticides, And then also our ground nesting birds, or bees. I'm not sure if you've ever seen them before, but I just saw some by my house and I'm like, oh, bare ground and it's friable soil. And I just saw these little holes and I'm like, oh, this is ground nesting bee habitats. So protection of spaces too for our ground nesting bees. I believe most of our native bees are ground nesting.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
And most of ours are solitary, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yes. Of our bees.
That I did know.
Yeah.
That I did know. You know, speaking of pollinators and speaking of bees, usually when I think the majority of people think about pollinators and they think of bees, they think of European honeybees.
Of course.
And that's a conversation that we've had here on the show. It's the, it's the uncomfortable conversation that people want to talk about because when they talk about all the problems that there are with honeybees, it's an invasive species in some regards. Mm-hmm. So I understand the need for them and what they bring to the table, but it's a double-edged sword in some cases.
It is.
And you have to be, it's something that has to be managed.
Yep.
Yeah. So, and as far as the non-native pollinators are concerned, the swings in population, it doesn't seem like and maybe you have new information on it, but it doesn't seem like we've ever been able to pin down exactly what the problem is, because just when you think we have something pinned down, it goes the other direction again and nothing's really changed. So
a lot of the research lately, at least, has shown to the use of insecticides.
Which would make sense.
Yeah. Right. That's what they're supposed to
do.
It's
what they do.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah,
especially the systemics.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I had a customer in here. Actually, I'll tell you the story when we come back. We need to take a break. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements and our special guest, Shay O'Keefe from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We'll be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements and our special guest, Shay O'Keefe from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. I was going to tell you a pollinator story when we went to the break. And what happened was, it's been a few years ago now, I had a customer come in. And this was back before Bayer AgroScience had sold off to, I can't remember who now, it's now BioAdvanced. And it was before the neonic ban went into effect. And used properly, neonics had, they were tremendous assets as far as landscaping and gardening is concerned. And a customer came in and I went over, and the specific problem that he had, there was one particular product from Bayer that I was my go-to, and I said, you know, said, well, this is what I would recommend. And he saw the bottle and he said, I don't want that. And I said, okay. And he said, yeah. He said, I don't want anything by Bayer. Bayer kills bees. And I didn't say it. I bit my tongue, but I wanted to tell him. I wanted to tell him, sir, everything on this 15-foot row of shelves kills bees. So it's not just Bayer, but it's how you manage it and how you use it. And if it's used judiciously and cautiously, it can be a tremendous time saver and really beneficial. Used improperly, it can be a disaster. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that we educate our customers on all the time, is the proper use of, if you have to use pesticides, the proper use of them is key.
Right.
Because it can easily be misused and cause all kinds of problems that you really weren't expecting. But when it comes to insecticides, that's what they do, is they kill insects, and they're usually pretty indiscriminate.
Kind of in the name.
They're, they're kind of indiscriminate in that matter. Mm-hmm. So, but like I said, there's different, whether you're using biologicals or you're using horticultural oils. There's mm-hmm. there's ways that you can mitigate the secondary damage, and we are really big on that and really try to push that.
I think the biggest problem is so many people want us to tell them what to eat. You give them something and they say, okay, how do I mix it? Like, well, it's on. You have to read the label. The label is the law, and they don't want that. They want you to say 1 ounce. They don't want to take the time to read it, and then the application rates, the frequency, when they can harvest, all that. So
that might be why the ready to use products are so popular, even though they're incredibly expensive compared to buying concentrates. The ready to use products, you don't have to mix anything.
But even that, people are, how often can I use it? They don't want to take the time to read that this should only be done at night, or you can only use it once a month or six times a year in the case of spinosad, right?
Spinosad is a prime example.
It's a great example. I use this every week on my plants.
You're not supposed to do that. Yeah. Was it asparagus? It's once every 6 months?
Or 60 days before you can harvest asparagus.
Yeah. But there's other things you can pick the next day. Yep. So anyway, one of the other things that that you have quite a bit of broad knowledge on, I'm assuming probably more so than any of us here at the table, is monarch butterflies, which are incredibly popular in in the gardening business. This year, unbelievable. I mean, the monarch people came out with a vengeance this year. It was unreal. Our milkweed suppliers could not keep it, and they couldn't grow it fast enough.
Right.
It was just amazing. And we probably sold more native milkweed this year than we have ever.
Right.
They had been gearing up for it for a while. It really started to hit, I think, during the pandemic.
Right.
People really, for whatever reason, when COVID came to town, people just jumped on the monarch bandwagon like you wouldn't believe. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about where we're at with monarchs, at least in Southern California in general. I know I don't know if it was ever finalized, but they were talking about putting them on the endangered list. Mm-hmm. Did that finally happen?
Still a candidate species.
Okay.
But we treat them as if. So trying to make sure that, you know, we're kind of ahead of the curve with that and how we help people help the land, basically. But yeah, they are, you know, in a couple of weeks, I get on a call with the Monarch Joint Venture Group, and we're going to discuss numbers. They'll get a count over this winter. They'll go to the overwintering sites, and we'll get a count on how well they're doing. The deal with the San Diego population, though, is there's a portion of it that's migratory, so it'll go to the Central Coast to overwinter and those big trees along the coast. And then there's a portion of the population that's residential. Right. Mm-hmm. So they stay here.
We call them that they were staycationing.
They're staycationing. Yeah. And those numbers are through the roof this year. Mm-hmm. And I am one of those people that kept going to the nurseries to get native milkweed because I couldn't feed these caterpillars fast enough. So, and we operate a little farm at my kid's school. I counted 350 caterpillars in one plot one day. They were just abundant. So I'm excited to see what the news is on these numbers because they've been doing so well this year. They're an insect. So there's a boom bust situation going on, possibly. There's so little known about what's going on with them. But my biggest message to people is to not plant the tropical variety. And if they do have it growing, which is that bright red leaf, right, or flower, is to cut it back in October. So now's the time to start cutting it back so we can minimize all of the pests that are on those tropical varieties. They also do carry a lot of pesticides in them when you get them from the bulk stores. So that's detrimental to the monarch. And you can kind of see when they come out of a chrysalis, their wings are kind of distorted a bit. So that's the sign of the parasite as well as possible contamination with insecticides. So that's why everybody's pushing the native milkweeds, and we have the narrow leaf, which is the one that everybody's trying to get right now.
Yeah, fasciculara.
Fasciculara.
Is there an S on the end? You're right. There is an S on there. Yeah.
Yes. So the narrow leaf is great. And then we've also got the woolly pod kind of at the higher elevation. It's a broader leaf, kind of a fuzzy leaf. And then we've got showy milkweed that's not as readily available, or you don't see it as much, but we have those three varieties in this county, at least for monarchs. But again, I'm so glad to see that everybody's after the native stuff. So it was a tough go. About 10 years ago, we really made a push with the Greater San Diego RCD to get available local stock of native milkweed, because we were bringing it down from Yolo County and it wasn't doing as well down here. So
what was RCD? I'm sorry.
It's a resource conservation district.
Got it. Okay.
And they started a pollinator alliance specifically for doing stuff for monarchs about 10 years ago with the Fish and Wildlife Service. So
one of the websites that I follow on a relatively regular basis as far as from a national standpoint for monarchs is the Texas Butterfly Ranch. And they publish a lot of articles written by entomologists, working entomologists. And one of the interesting articles that I read not too long ago was, it was an entomologist that had published it, and he said that they were talking about monarchs being endangered. And they said, and it is specifically with the migration, and he said there's a train of thought amongst some circles now that it's not so much the insects themselves that are as endangered as it is their migratory pattern, because with the explosion of the planting of people planting milkweed and the explosion of milkweed in people's yards and urban areas, they're just not going anywhere anymore. Right. And he said it's not, like I said, their take was that it wasn't so much that the species themselves is endangered, but the migratory pattern is changing, and they are evolving based on what the current living conditions are, which I thought was really interesting, because I can see where, you know, up in the red, if the population drops up in the Central Coast, it may be that they're just hanging around down here because they don't need to move. You know, if you've got the food, but then that brings up all the other questions that it's a system.
Right.
And when you start introducing disruptors into the system, it changes a lot of things.
Right. And that's one of the kind of the rules of thumb we have for people that have overwintering sites is to not plant milkweed around there, because they break pause. So you don't want them to forget their life cycle, so to speak. So please go overwinter. Don't mate and make more caterpillars right now, because they're going to hatch when it's freezing, right? So we try and not have people plant milkweed around known overwintering sites, and to just get that nectar resource out there for them. It's not just about planting milkweed. Get all kinds of stuff out there for them. And it doesn't always have to be natives. There's some great non-natives out there, like calendula. Oh my God, they love that stuff. So branch out a little bit.
Well, I know in my yard for a few years ago, we were planting a lot of milkweed and a lot of other flowering plants to get the monarchs into our yard and help them out. The past couple of years have been a disaster for us monarch-wise because of taxon flies.
Oh my gosh, yes.
This year we planted no milkweed at all. We planted a lot of other flowering plants, salvias and natives and things like that. Yeah. So we get the butterflies coming through, but they're not laying their eggs.
Yeah.
And I'm specifically not going to plant milkweed for at least a couple of years to try to get the taxon population down, because I don't think we had any caterpillars go through their entire life cycle, because they all got predated by the taxon flies.
Eat that fly.
Oh, it's terrible. That's terrible. It's horribly destructive as far as monarchs are concerned. It can be beneficial for other
tomato hornworms,
but right. But you know, it's that's the other thing that you can do.
So the key takeaway for those people that like tropical milkweed for the look is to make sure they just cut it back in October. I know that we read before Thanksgiving, but to cut it back to stop those overwintering pathogens.
Yep.
Okay. And I want to make sure that's the key thing here.
Yeah.
Another thing that we run into when there's a run on milkweed, which happened quite a bit this year, and milkweed's not available, I have heard that you can feed them butternut squash, that the caterpillars.
I heard that too.
I have heard. So you've not tried that.
Yeah. Hoping you're going to agree with
that. I would love to see a little bit of data on that. So if you have it, yes, please share.
I will. Next time I see some, I will put some butternut squash out and we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ with our special guest, Shay O'Keefe, who's the wildlife biologist for the United States Department of Agriculture here in Southern California. Shay, thank you very much for coming in and spending some time with us. We will have you back again. It's been fun.
All right.
We will be back next week with another hour of Garden Talk. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.